year, the Islamic Human Rights Commission's Check Your Dates campaign takes on extra significance as they've released a list of date brands that are certified to be Palestinian. The Zionist regime regularly labels their stolen dates as Jordanian or from the West Bank, or sells them on the supermarket brands without always mentioning the country of origin. So the campaign urges believers to constantly ensure that they're checking their brands. Other campaigns are focusing on exerting financial pressure on the Zionist entity and its supporters. Barclays Bank in particular has come into focus as campaigners call for a boycott of the British financial institution due to the more than £1 billion they've invested in the Zionist economy. Another major company which has come under fire has been Starbucks, who sued the workers' union when they declared their solidarity with Palestine. The global coffee giant has been targeted by protests and boycotts ever since, severely hurting the company's bottom line. While a painting of the man behind the Balfour Declaration, Lord Balfour, was destroyed by campaigners at the University of Cambridge. Perhaps the most impactful actions have been undertaken by the Palestine Action Group, who have managed to bring to a halt the activities of a number of facilities belonging to the Israeli weapons manufacturer Elbit Systems, forcing them, in many instances, to close down their factories completely. All these actions and so many more have heaped immense pressure on Israel and its supporters across the world, highlighting their barbaric and savage nature, stripping away any vestige that they are in any way a civilized or moral people.
Now joining us on the show this week to discuss the importance of activism against oppression, especially during Shahr Ramadan, are two very special guests. We're joined by Fatima Merchant, who has years of experience in organizing demonstrations for causes in Palestine, Nigeria, Yemen, and others. She has been an avid campaigner for human rights and is the co-host of the Liberated Voices podcast. We're also joined by Brother Ibrahim Abul Asad. Ibrahim is a UK-based Palestinian researcher, photojournalist, and activist. Assalamu alaikum to you both. Thank you so much for joining us on Eye on Islam. Sister Fatima, if I could begin with you, what has been your experience of the Muslim reaction in the UK, particularly to the ongoing genocide in Gaza?
Well, as we know that this didn't start on October 7th, there has been a huge shift in attitudes, particularly within the Muslim communities. I think it's clear to see that instead of it being seen as more of a political issue, it's now become one that is seen as humanitarian, as it should be, especially with the lead up to, you know, and now, alhamdulillah, we are in Shahr Ramadan. It's become more mainstream within the Muslim community, as it should be. There is still a lot more that could be done.
Absolutely. Ibrahim, there is a lot of variety in the actions to be taken. We've seen, you know, from cultural events to boycott campaigns. In your opinion, what are the most effective ways to campaign against the Zionist regime during this holy month?
First and foremost, I'd like to say Happy Ramadan. To answer bluntly, to mobilise and campaign outside these arms factories that make the weapons that are used to kill Palestinians as well as many oppressed people across the global south. And as well, not just these arms factories, but to apply pressure upon all the pressure points that Zionism has here in the UK. Now, what is that? Universities. They have a substantial amount of deals with companies that create weapons as well as components or have different types of investments in occupied Palestine. So what we really need to do now is up our level, up our game when it comes to applying pressure upon these pressure points, upon these institutions that are Zionist, that work towards Israel's effort to occupy, Israel's effort to kill, Israel's effort to displace, Israel's effort to maim Palestinians from the river to the sea.
I mean, just quickly, you mentioned, obviously, universities. What could some students do? Let's say there are students watching this. What are some effective things that maybe they could do on their campuses?
Well, not just students, but everybody needs to know the political climate that we need to operate in. Now, it being students, we need to know what is a Zionist organization, what are Zionist organizations that are present at campus, on campus. And one organization that every single student and pro-Palestinian advocate needs to know about is the UJS, the Union of Jewish Students, that works towards demonizing and in an effort criminalizing Palestinians as well as students that are literally advocating for the right belonging to the Palestinian people. Very important point is that Nina Friedman, who was the former UJS president, has spoken on video at an event full of UJS alumni. She clearly says, not my words, Nina Friedman's words, that the UJS alumni have members in the Israeli military, the Israeli political office, different bureaucracies within Israel. So how is the UJS not clearly an extension of Zionism here in the UK? Students need to know who the UJS is. Anytime that you see a UJS event, you go to your local PALSOC, you inform them. You go to PALSOC such as that you see in SOAS University, that you see in UCL, as well as that you see in countless other London-based universities and non-London-based universities, and demand that any event organised by the UJS or Zionist organisations should not be held on our campus.
No, absolutely. And Fatima, I would say, just before we, you know, move on to some of the spiritual dimensions, do you think Muslims have been doing enough? I mean, do you think that as a community in general, we see the young generally are more maybe mobilised and active and on campuses and doing stuff. Do you think maybe we could be doing more?
Absolutely, you should be doing more. Especially as a student, you've got that position where you can be doing more. Within universities, there is so much opportunity to stand up, especially because these are the institutions that are complicit, you know. And essentially, you're paying the university, and the university is paying to kill. So, absolutely, you should be doing more. The students should be standing up, not just in the ways previously discussed, but there's this campaign of silencing going on. Wearing even the Palestinian badge or having any sort of political standpoint can be demonised, although it's not legal. That's where you need to understand that if it's not illegal,
don't be intimidated.
Don't be intimidated and
do it. And I guess, you know, we've spoken already about some of the physical, material actions that we can take. What are some of the spiritual actions or some spiritual dimensions to this struggle that Muslims can engage in specifically during Shahr Ramadan?
Absolutely. So, as we've seen in Rafah, the children, they look up to the sky and they don't know whether it's dinner or death.
Right?
It's a devastating situation. And so, when we are fasting, usually we think, okay, we are doing this for patience, we are doing this to have sabr, to find that inner peace. These Palestinian children, they've been doing it for months now.
Yeah.
And if we can't empathise with them, not just on a material level, but on a spiritual level, then what are we doing? We need to look within us, and as we are fasting, we need to find that spiritual side within us that empathises with these kids in Gaza, that empathises with the struggles that these people can't have a break from. There is no iftar. There is nothing, I mean, grinding up animal feed. Subhanallah, and here we are thinking that we might have dates from Israel, and who cares?
Yeah,
it's horrendous. So when you're doing your zikr, when you're doing your fast, when you're going about your daily life and you think, oh, I'm hungry, oh, I feel thirsty, find that part of you that connects with the rest of the ummah on a spiritual level.
Yeah. And quickly, Ibrahim, do you think that we, as Muslims, sometimes underestimate the power of da'a? Like, you know, maybe some people say, oh, pray for the people of Palestine, but actually it's the weapon of the believer as far as we understand.
100%, as much as we must always pray for the people of Palestine, we should also must make an act of duty in, for example, making sure that we are not breaking our fast on Israeli-produced dates that was produced on stolen Palestinian land. Of course, we should always pray for the people of Gaza, but we should also make sure that we are not our actions are in line with our prayer, and they don't contradict, because quite frankly, it's very bittersweet. Very bittersweet that we're breaking and we're surrounding by our loved members, our family members, while Palestinians are surrounded by the rubble of their homes, eating animal feed, breathing in white phosphorus for breakfast. It's disgusting, and quite frankly, it's harrowing. And I think what we saw recently, seeing mosque in London invite genocide enabler Rishi Sunak, yeah. In my opinion, it's quite disgusting. Because I don't think any individual that has advocated for the killing of any people, regardless of their religion or regardless of their race or creed, for profit...
should be welcome anyway. Yeah.
Whether it be this room, my house, your house, my religious centre or your religious centre.
Absolutely, absolutely. No, absolutely. Thank you. Now, with the large-scale crackdown, as we've mentioned, touched on student action on campuses across the UK, Ayan Islam attended a pro-Palestine fundraising event at a London university and heard from the students directly as to why they planned this action, specifically during the holy month of Ramadan.
In my opinion, being proactive and standing for justice, is inherently Islamic. And so I think it's something that we actually need to do. With regard to it being public or private, I think what we're doing here today isn't necessarily something that you need to be a Muslim to do. Even though we said it's inherently Islamic, if people differ to that, then you can turn around and say, well, look, this is a humanitarian cause. And I don't think anyone has any valid basis to use how public or private their religious beliefs are to stand with what's right.
I'm a first-year law student. I'm also president of the SJP Society, Students for Justice in Palestine. And we're here today because we've seen that individual efforts aren't enough. We need more combined efforts. So that's why we've come, we've coalitioned with different societies, and we're trying to make a big scene here so that we can really get our message across. We've tried our best to communicate with the university, express how unhappy we've been that they've been neglecting the issue of Palestine. They haven't shown enough attention to it. They haven't respected our request. We've asked them to raise the flag like they do for other causes. They haven't respected our request, basically. So we're going to try our best to put on a scene here and display the flag everywhere possible and keep chanting Free Palestine.
We feel to a point pushed to have to do something. There's now a coalition of societies. It started off as two or three societies, but we're now, I think, 15 or 16 societies in total have come together. So it's clearly something which is supported by a very broad and large element of the student base. And there's even academic staff, members of staff, who have voiced their solidarity with the cause as well, and the fact that they want to see things that are different. But we've heard they've been outright scared to do so. One member of staff earlier today came and slapped this on the wall and actually told us. You know, we had a conversation with him afterwards. He was genuinely scared. He was trying to conceal his identity. And he was a Jewish member of staff. Which goes to show that this isn't, just a Muslim cause. It's a global cause, it's a humanitarian cause, and I feel, like I said, when we started this, obligated to speak out. And I think most students are starting to see that as well.
Now, Fatima, we just saw some footage from an event there at a London university, and I think one of the things that came through from that event is attempts to intimidate students on campus to maybe make them feel like they could be harmed in their studying or their prospects, or some kind of consequences could come upon them. What advice would you have to particularly the younger students in terms of how to face down these attempts at intimidation, whether it be by extremists on campus, like Ibrahim was talking about in the Union of Jewish Students, or even members of staff?
Of course, well, first of all, well done to those students that put that action in place. That is what we need. You cannot feel intimidated by these people because they have no backing. There is no ground for them to stand on, essentially. For the younger students in particular, you've just now entered into a space where you've found this newfound power. And you need to recognise that as a student. A lot of student activism is undermined, but actually it plays a huge part in getting things done, in changing the way people see things, even in legislation. So it is so important that as a younger student, look to those that are older than you in perhaps higher years or even alumni, and see how they've interacted with the difficulties they faced. Because this isn't something new. We know that this issue has been ongoing. So there are sources and resources out there where you can look to, and you should find power and solidarity with the students that you're with, because now you're no longer just one, you're part of a bigger whole.
Yeah, you've got the critical mass.
Just to add on that note, I think to the students that are watching, to one organisation and one movement definitely worth following, and also asking for assistance if you do feel any trouble on campus, is YFFP, Youth Front for Palestine, based in the north of England, in Manchester, as well as PYN Britain, that is based in London. Because they are youth-led, they themselves have gone through many of these very similar experiences on the back of the UJS's efforts to demonise and criminalise anything of anybody calling for the rights belonging to the Palestinian people. So those two, what that organisation and the Palestinian youth movement, are amazing avenues to get in contact with if you are experiencing any form of trouble on campus and you need to speak to somebody more experienced that can help alleviate the situation.
Just sorry, on that note, I think it's really important, actually, that students remember that they do have their rights. And as Ibrahim was saying, it is so important that you are educated in that sense. So when you are holding these actions, don't be intimidated because you have rights. So make sure you know them and therefore can use them.
Yes. Sure. And Ibrahim, I would want to come back to the question of, you know, Shahr Ramadan, and in terms of religiosity. What would you say to those who say that actually people or Muslims shouldn't be concerning themselves with political matters in general, or even during this special time of the year?
Then I think it contradicts a lot of my own personal beliefs, and as well as a lot of beliefs of the Muslim community, when we see injustices unfolding across the world. I think I myself as a human being, I myself as a Muslim, I myself as Ibrahim, cannot just sit there and continue to digest my food while a Palestinian boy is starving and has been starving for over 150 days and looks to the sky and doesn't know whether there's food coming from the above or if it's a bomb raining to steal the life of his mother, his brother, his sister, as well as his father. I think it's shameful. I think shameful. Yeah. Nothing. No other words to put in between. I think there's much more that Muslims themselves, as well as the Muslim community, are amazing in terms of what they have done for Palestine, as well as we need to take it many more steps further.
Sister Fatima, we've seen many reports of the British government's attempts to try to redefine extremism in order to maybe try to tamp down support for Palestine amongst people in the UK, Muslims and non-Muslims who have come out to support Palestine. Do you think they'll be successful in their attempts?
They've tried, and they've tried again, and we're still on the streets. So whilst, yes, we can see they are having an impact, people are starting to understand that it doesn't matter what they say or how many times they try to redefine extremism or how much they try to broaden it or how much they try to snatch you into this loop or that loop or this label or whatever. What actually matters is whether you are able to continue going out. So as long as we have that right, and as long as this is a democratic country, you will have that right. So don't be intimidated. And I mean, they'll keep trying. They won't stop. They won't relax. But neither will we.
Do you think they'll be successful, Ibrahim? But also, do you think that it's a sign of their desperation that they're trying to crack down in this way, that they maybe are worried about how much the narrative has changed? And, you know, especially the young generation. I just want to take it very quickly somewhere else. In America, there's a debate going on and expected to be passed very soon that TikTok will be banned.
Yes.
The main driving force of this, nothing to do, of course, with China, and everything to do with the fact that the ADL, yes, the Jewish Extremist Organization, is worried that the younger generation who get their news from TikTok are seeing things how they are. And do you think this is what's reflected in government policy here? They're so panicking, especially that younger people are not supporting Israel anymore, that they're trying to do all of this, ban protests and call people extremists to try to, because of how successful these actions have been.
100%. Just before starting off, I think the only extremist thing is what's coming out of the Cabinet Office and coming out of Rishi Sunak's mouth, the fact that he is supporting an entity that is committing genocide and actively spoke about their genocidal intent. I think with the question regarding TikTok, it's a very interesting question because we no longer have two camps where it is the left and the right. Instead, it is the old and the young. And the old will soon die, and the young continue to get old, and the young have the dominant view that Palestine should be liberated from the river to the sea, because they are seeing the injustices and their mind hasn't been tampered with institutionally by going through their ages of life. So I think that is very telling. I think what is very telling is the fact that protests, our right to protests, is what allowed us to have the establishment of the National Health Service here in this country. It was working class men going to go out to fight in World War II, coming back without a leg, without an arm, without any form of service, health-wise, taking to the streets, demanding their right. Given that I fought blood, sweat and tears for your country, the least you can do is accommodate me in terms of healthcare. That is how we had the NHS. That is the same people that Boris Johnson wanted us to clap for at 8 o'clock. And you are now saying that you want to strip our right from protesting when protesting literally gave something that this country regards itself as one of its greatest achievements, a national free health service. And just to conclude, I think we shouldn't get lost in everything that's been taking place post October the 7th, thinking that it's happening in a vacuum. Because just like how it didn't take place on October the 7th, their attempts to criminalize Palestinian activity across Western Europe did not take place post October the 7th. This has been an effort to criminalizing our right to protest before last year. And we see it accelerated in places like Germany, where organizations are unable to receive state funding if they support BDS. And we're soon on the trajectory to see that happening here in the UK. So none of this should be seen to have happened in a vacuum, whether it be the events that led up to October the 7th or the events that led after October the 7th.
And just very finally, Fatima, maybe actually I want to pick up on that last point that Brother Ibrahim made about funding. So, you know, there are attempts, and there have been actually legislation passed in many states in the US where you wouldn't get access to, you know, funds and contracts or other access to public money if you support BDS or you're anti-Zionist. Isn't that a good thing, though? I mean, what we really want is our communities to be independent from the state, right, and not be reliant on the state. Because we've seen many of those who do take money from the state, you know, to promote narratives like Prevent and others, have actually been very compromised. So in the long term, isn't it good that people divorce themselves from being reliant on these, you know, kind of authoritarian Western regimes?
I think I want to just flip that on its head quickly, because the way we look at it is so important. Mm. When you are given money by the state doesn't give it to you without its you know, expectations.
Strings attached. Yeah, exactly.
So now Rishi's pledged, what, 117 million to the security of mosques and Muslim faith-based schools and whatever over the next 4 years. What does that come with? That's not just coming out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. There is a reason that it's coming out now, and there's a reason that it's this amount of money, and there's a reason that it's based to the Muslim community. Mm-hmm. When the Muslims have been vocal, now it's suddenly time to fund them, mm-hmm. to silence them, essentially. When, you know, when we're all happy in our place and the Muslim, you know, community is more worried about spiritual issues rather than perhaps current affairs or the idea of, you know, Prevent is something to help us all and it's not biased or whatever. Well, when you're silent and you're already within their pocket, they don't need to buy you to put you in their pocket. Does that make sense?
It's
so important that not only are you scared, you shouldn't be scared of not receiving funding, you should be scared of receiving funding.
Yep.
Exactly.
Which has been my position, because what are the strings that come attached with it? Thank you so much, Sister Fatima, and Brother Ibrahim as well, for your time and your excellent contributions. And thank you. You can join us again next week for another edition of Eye on Islam. Assalamu alaikum.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. In the blessed month of Ramadan, the residents of Gaza are facing famine because of Israel's policy of deliberate starvation, with the sole objective being to make Gaza virtually uninhabitable. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Iran's Press TV has covered this story and tells us more. Ramadan, one of the most sacred months for Muslims worldwide, blends spiritual introspection with family life in the community, especially during the breaking of the fast known as Iftar. But for the inhabitants of war-ravaged Gaza, this month will be different from all previous ones. Gaza has been enduring a genocidal war marked by bombings, siege, and the dehumanization of Palestinians. This dehumanization turns children, pregnant women, and the elderly into legitimate targets for Israeli soldiers. Harrowing images from Gaza have become symbols of the cruelty of the settler colonial regime. This Ramadan, the residents of Gaza are facing famine due to the Israeli policy of deliberate starvation, with the sole objective being to make Gaza virtually uninhabitable. This situation arises because Israel has failed to weaken the Hamas resistance group militarily or propose a plan for Gaza's future that does not involve Hamas as a representative of the people of Gaza. As a consequence of these abject failures, Israel has opted for a new strategy in Gaza to create a situation where no one emerges victorious, even though it is the regime that has faced defeat. The strategy of rendering Gaza uninhabitable and ungovernable involves provoking absolute chaos in the territory and creating a situation of full-scale famine. According to this toxic colonial strategy, if no political force is capable of maintaining even a minimum of governmental stability in the territory, it becomes entirely dependent on humanitarian aid. In the case of Gaza, the famine strategy designed by the Zionist colonial occupation is complemented by the distribution of humanitarian aid by the United States, described by many as a show reinforcing the dependency of the Palestinian territory and keeping it in a state of permanent chaos. The images of malnourished Palestinian bodies have become common on social media sites in recent days, even though the mainstream Western media continues to reduce these colossal human losses into cold statistics. The graphic images of mutilated bodies or malnourished babies are part of the daily reality faced by Palestinians of Gaza. The issue is not to create despair or evoke sympathy, but to expose the atrocities of the Zionist colonial occupation regime, which has assumed frightening proportions since 7th of October last year. Israel obsessively concerns itself with its public image, making desperate attempts to hide its genocidal crimes. However, in the battle for narratives, Zionist Hasbara, the propaganda organ of the colonial entity, has failed to conceal the reality of genocide and starvation it has imposed on Palestinians. During this holy month, it is also important to highlight the colonial expansion in other parts of Palestine, such as the occupied West Bank. Recently, the colonial regime approved the construction of more illegal settlements in the region. Many tougher restrictions have also been imposed on Palestinian worshippers from accessing the Al-Aqsa Mosque during the sacred month of Ramadan, with reports of multiple deadly raids on several parts of the occupied city of Al-Quds, recently resulting in the martyrdom of at least 4 Palestinians. One of them was a 13-year-old teenage Palestinian boy who was shot and martyred by an Israeli sniper whilst bursting firecrackers outside his house near Shufat camp in occupied city of Al-Quds. The genocide and starvation in Gaza are meticulously designed to inflict harm and create atrocious conditions for the local population. Several Gaza residents have spoken about the deliberate destruction of farmland in the area, aiming to keep the population subdued and deprived of any ability to feed themselves. The destruction of fertile soil in Gaza with the clear aim of causing famine can also be understood through the decision of the occupying regime to flood tunnels in Gaza with seawater. According to several experts, this action would have led to the destruction of these soils and their potential agricultural use. Amid death and destruction, Israel continues its psychological warfare against Palestinians of Gaza. The leaflets dropped by the regime urge people to feed the needy, which rights activists perceive as a cruel irony given the situation of famine imposed by Israel itself. The message of feeding the needy reveals the insignificance of Palestinian lives to the colonial forces. Furthermore, it underscores the dehumanization of the Palestinian population and, along with it, the normalization of extermination, domination, exploitation, premature death, and even conditions worse than death, such as ruthless torture. For decades, Palestinians have lived in constant anticipation of death, a reality dating back before even 1947. Colonized individuals often anticipate degradation, humiliation, and murder. During the month of Ramadan, the Muslim community is particularly aware of the divine blessings in their daily lives. The notion of divinity should not be interpreted as something separate from earthly reality. On the contrary, the divinity of the Holy Quran implies a political struggle to establish a just community in this world. We cannot speak of justice, much less build a just society, while Gaza and the rest of Palestine continue to suffer genocide and starvation. The English website of Al Mayadeen Television Network has also covered the same story and tells us more. Ramadan, the month of fasting and divine grace, has commenced again. Fasting is not merely an abstention from food, but an exercise in self-restraint and self-discipline. It's also the time for Muslims to reflect on the challenges that they face and reaffirm their commitment to the Quranic teachings of unity and standing up against all forms and manifestations of evil. At the moment, the most pressing issue for Muslims is related to the besieged Gaza Strip, where the US-backed Israeli war of genocide, now in its 6th month, has already claimed over tens of thousands of precious lives, many of them Palestinian women and children. The efforts to broker a truce between the commencement of the holy month, in which the Holy Quran was revealed in its entirety, failed to materialize due to the occupying regime's hard-nosed stance. With Israel intent on committing more massacres and war crimes ahead of a potential invasion of southern Gaza Strip, city of Rafah, it is clear that securing the release of Israeli captives in Gaza was never high on Israel's agenda. What they seek is the obliteration of Hamas, which in reality means the Palestinians of Gaza. As the month of mercy, Ramadan has always been an opportune time to bring about ceasefire agreements, as was the case between Saudi Arabia and Yemen, who agreed to a truce agreement in 2022, coinciding with the start of Ramadan that year. The ethnic Malay Muslim separatists in Thailand and the Thai government have also agreed in principle to a ceasefire spanning the holy month of Ramadan and the Thai festival of Songkran in mid-April. Earlier this week, the UN Security Council also adopted a UK-drafted resolution that called for a Ramadan ceasefire in Sudan amid the country's devastating civil war. One of the reasons Ramadan is known as the Month of Mercy is because the gates of heaven are open while those of hell are considered closed to the sincere believers.
Conversation. You're still tuned into The Conversation, your weekly alternative probe of political events and current affairs around Ireland. I'm joined by our special guests, Dr. Mark Humphreys from Ireland Israel Alliance, along with Hamza Tortsis from the Sapien Institute. Mark had asked, do you see the impact that it's had on Jews?
Of course I do. I consider myself empathic. The impact it has had, of course, is going to be traumatic. If that's how they perceive things, I'm not denying the impact, whether it's propaganda or not. So I do empathize from that perspective. But at the end of the day, I already said there's been five equivalent in October the 7th since 2008 from a numbers perspective, from killing innocent human beings, from killing Palestinians. Why the moral asymmetry? Why do you believe Israeli blood is worth more than Palestinian blood? Because you're not even bothered to address. Bothered to address that reality. There are five equivalent October the 7th inflicted on the Palestinians before October the 7th.
You're talking. First of all,
Just be honest. You don't care about Palestinian blood.
No, first, I
just care. You don't care.
What I want for Palestinians.
You're racist, right? Or ignorant. One of those.
What
two.
I want for Palestinians.
You want them to be impressed, and you want them to respond to the oppression in the way that you want.
No. I've been clear. I've been clear my whole life. What I want for Palestinians is I want them to live in peace and prosperity.
Okay.
And for
stop
me,
the apartheid.
Hold on. For me,
illegal occupations.
Hold on. For me, the fundamental thing that is stopping Palestinians and has been stopping them since before they were called Palestinians, which a name that emerged in the 60s.
That's not true.
Anyway. The thing that is stopping Palestinians from living in peace and prosperity is their own ideas, the ideas that are in their heads. Now that makes this potentially.
Do you know the opinions, the whole of the Palestinians? You know all of the ideas.
Let me just try and make the point, which is in some conflicts in the world, you just have to fight. You have to keep up the struggle. You have no chance at all. You're being brutalized by some neighboring dictator. The struggle is, you know, perhaps decimating your country, but if you give up the struggle, you'll just be decimated even more by the dictator, whatever. There are many, perhaps most wars in history are like that. You just have to fight whoever is up against you. The Israel war, I believe, is not and never has been like that. The war between Israel and the Arabs and then Israel and the Palestinians is a war where if the Palestinians modified their ideas, everybody could live in peace and prosperity. And it's harder to see on the West Bank, where there's no agreed definition of territory. It was unbelievably easy to see in Gaza from 2005 to 2023. All the Gazans had to do was stop, and they had a solution. It was right there waiting for them for 18 years, but they wouldn't take it. Instead, they wanted to continue the war. They fired rockets at Israel, which inevitably brought Israel back to attack Hamas, to do aerial bombing, because sending in troops on the ground means dead Israelis, so they did aerial bombing. They did send in troops. I've met some of the troops who went in on the ground, but very few went in until 2023.
Because they're cowards, that's why.
That's why they wear nappies. Hold on. Calm. Right. First of all...
I am calm. I said they wear nappies. It's a fact.
First of all, if they go in on the ground, they die, right? Any troops that go in the ground die. But also, combat on the ground is also very dangerous for local civilians. They die as well, too. It just escalates.
So how does this actually present a case against... You've mentioned some untruths there, but no, how does this go against my presentation? Well, we've shown intent, and we've shown the actions that support the intent.
There's no intent.
There's no intent?
No, they said intent.
The ministers, people of positions of power, we have over 100 statements, including the IDF, a general, the people of significant power, think tanks, having genocidal statements, and the dumb bombs, around 50% of the bombs are not even laser-guided, right, just to annihilate everything.
Okay, well, let me say a few things.
That's not genocide?
Okay, Hamza, let Mark just...
Let me say a few things to the core of it, right? I don't agree with statements talking about Amalekites and stuff like that. I understand anger and hurt and fury on the Israeli side. I mean, I can feel it, and I'm not Israeli. I can understand that anger, but I don't agree with Amalekite-type statements or anything like that. So what you have to look at is what's actually happening. Right? So what's actually happening compared to those statements? So, for example, one of the first things that happened was an announcement for civilians to get out.
I've already mentioned that.
Northern Gaza, right? And get into southern Gaza.
And then you just bomb when they're evacuating. You kill them when they're evacuating.
That's not what happened.
Aerial analysis has proven that.
We'll give the figures for which EuroMed have given the Swiss monitoring group. And they have given the figures of almost 30,000 Palestinians killed. Now, to go back to that point, the bombing of northern Gaza, how can it be said that it was precision bombing when there were that many civilians killed? I just want to get to the core of that. Do you believe that's just collateral damage? Or do the Israelis just believe that's collateral damage? Or how do we square that circle?
Okay, so Israel set itself the job of destroying a group that controls all of Gaza, essentially, Hamas. So it's an unbelievably ambitious job, which it has never attempted before, to take an entire territory and wipe out the militant terrorist group that's in charge of it. Now, probably every fact I say, Hamza, is going to challenge, but...
You're providing no citations, no evidence, nothing.
But Gaza north and south Gaza north and south is practically an armed camp in the sense that the there's a tunnel system of several hundred kilometers. Presumably, you agree that exists. The tunnel system is going underneath apartment blocks. It's going underneath mosques. They found openings to the tunnels. In mosques, in schools, in private houses. There was a report there that the IDF said that every single mosque they had searched so far on the ground and every single school that they had searched on the ground had either weapons or a tunnel underneath it. Now, you may not believe any of this. I certainly believe that's true because that is the way Hamas would fight. It is the kind of morality that Hamas would believe in, the tactics that they would use. So it's an incredibly hard job to clear out Gaza, which is why they've started doing it sector by sector. They wanted to move the population down to the south. Now they're dropping leaflets. They've divided the south up into zones, and the leaflets are saying things like, here in this red sector, we are going to be, there's going to be fighting and bombing in this red sector today. Move along this road into these green sectors. So, now, it's not very nice for people who live there to be told with a message from the enemy from the sky, get out of your house and you may never see it again, move down the road. But why are they doing this, is the point, if their aim is genocide? And show me any army that would do this in the history of the world.
But this is a red herring. This is totally irrelevant. The point
why
is,
why are they doing it?
Okay, so
no, you
why would the Gazans believe the IDF when the IDF have told them to move, and when they've moved, they've been bombed?
They haven't bombed them.
They have. The aerial analysis has been shown by independent entities.
They bombed Hamas fighters.
No, they have. Well, women, children.
They bombed.
Is a child a Hamas fighter? Is a child a Hamas fighter?
Well, if you're saying...
Are 11,000 children Hamas fighters?
Well, hold on.
It's genocidal language, dehumanizing language.
Are children fighting for Hamas?
Are children, Hamas fighters.
By definition.
And are they guilty?
If we know,
should they be bombed?
Hold on.
Should we kill children? Is that what you believe?
If we know nothing other than it's a child, then they're not a Hamas fighter. If they're under 10 years old, they're not a Hamas fighter. If they're over 10 years old, are over 10-year-olds being used by Hamas? Because I've seen plenty of evidence that they are. As spotters, as runners, as carriers of ammunition.
So basically that language is basically blurring the boundary between a combatant and a non-combatant.
It's not language. I'm talking about what you're Hamas are doing.
So you're basically saying it's okay. Because of that, we should kill everybody. Is that what you're saying?
Well, if I was saying that, wouldn't I say it rather than you?
Well, I don't know. You've said a lot of things without any basis.
Rather than you having to say, oh, so
look,
you're saying
let's think about your framing. This is very important. The way you're framing it as if there are two state actors that are fighting each other. It's not symmetrical. There's an asymmetry. When you're talking about Gaza that was left alone in 2005, it's still known under international law as an occupied territory. Secondly, they control even the daily calories. Academics have called it perverse, degrading, and unlivable in many places. So from that perspective, the way you're framing it as if there are two state actors and there's a war. It's not a war. In actual fact, Israel, under international law, has no right to defend itself. Why? Because it's already in
Israel has no right to defend itself.
Yeah, according to international law. Let me explain why.
So after 7th of October,
can I explain
Israel
why?
Should do nothing.
I'm not saying that. Listen to what I'm saying.
What should Israel do then?
They should stop the apartheid regime. They should stop the illegal settlements. They should stop oppressing the Palestinians. They should stop killing children. They should stop forcibly imprisoning children. The list goes on and on and on. That's what they should do. You want peace? Don't be an oppressor. If you want peace, don't have apartheid. There are 65 laws that discriminate against Arab Israelis and Palestinians.
We're on to a new
Are you happy with apartheid?
We're on to a new topic every 2 seconds.
Are you happy with apartheid?
Hold on. My problem with
sounds
this,
like it.
My problem with this debate is there's a new topic every 2 seconds.
You're not directly answering my questions. That's why.
Let Mark speak.
I think we ought to dig into some topics and go a bit slower. I'm happy to discuss all these topics, by the way, but a new topic every 2 seconds is a bit hard to cope with.
No, because I'm just challenging you.
We need to stick with the topic.
I'm challenging the misframing.
We need to stick to the topic with which the reasons why you're here. I think we need to stick that. So go ahead, Mark. Make your point.
There's about 100 trucks a day going into in aid. Going into in food.
Not answering the question.
Hold on. Going into Gaza right now. The issue. Sorry, if we're back to the issue of genocidal intent. Well, the question is, why are these leaflets being dropped from the sky? Not just that, but phone calls as well. There's been several million text messages, many thousands of phone calls because they're much more human intensive. There are accounts from Gazans. One of them was the caretaker of an apartment block. He said Israelis were on the phone with him for 2 hours explaining who they were attacking, when, why his people had to get out of the apartment block and when it was safe to go back. Now, my point is not that absolutely everything Israel ever does in a war is going to be perfect and that can be justified. That wouldn't be true for any war in human history. People make errors and people get enthusiastic and people misidentify and people do commit crimes as well. But my point is that there are too many things that don't fit in with your simple claim that Israel just wants to kill everybody. And we start off with all the warnings.
No, I didn't actually say that.
Well,
I said
genocide
that
is killing everyone in the territory.
No,
right?
For example, you believe in the Armenian genocide, right? You believe that the Ottomans committed an Armenian genocide. Is that true?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
But I don't think we should talk about that.
No, I'm not saying that.
10 minutes.
I want to show your maybe inconsistent principles here, because there is no proof of intent for genocide there, yet you believe it's a genocide. Also, the other Armenians towards the east were untouched. So a genocide doesn't mean, even according to your own perspective...
At the risk of discussing it, they drove them all into the desert.
Yeah, but
you're
missing the point, though. But they want to drive the Gazans, and they've been starving the Gazans, too. I'm showing the inconsistency, because it's related to the point. It's about genocide. You believe in a genocide, but you can't prove intent of a genocide. The point is, you have an entity, the Gaza Strip, that the Israelis have full control over the water, the electricity, and the food, to the degree that they said there can be only this many calories per day, according to academics. So my point here is, how is that now an independent state and your framing of that there is, like, you know, a symmetrical war going on.
Well, how come...
And that's my point. So my point is...
How come before 2023, if Israel was so evil, they were providing electricity and water to Gaza? How come?
Well, yeah.
If they're so evil.
Yeah, but they were controlling it.
But if they're so evil, why didn't they just cut it off before 2023?
Well, wait, hold on a second.
They were providing electricity and why, water to Gaza.
Yeah, but if Gaza had its own... And that just proves my point. So you've actually proved my point, which is Gaza doesn't have control. Israel's providing water, electricity, Gaza doesn't have control. So how can they flourish when they don't have control?
Gaza before 2023, of course it didn't have full control of its own territory. I never claimed it did. What I claimed was that there was a route for them to peace, prosperity. For example, Israel was
but they're occupied.
They weren't occupied.
International law, Gaza is considered an occupied entity even post-2005.
Hold on. Israel...
Do you believe in international law?
Just not a new topic.
Yeah, but it's not a new topic. You're making a statement that's just making things up.
As I say, Hamza, it's a new topic every 2 seconds.
It's related, actually.
They are related, but let's spend a bit of time on the topic and then go on to the next one.
Sure.
What I'm saying is... that fighting an enemy like Hamas is unbelievably difficult.
No, but you're framing it. Okay, let me explain why this framing is all wrong. Number one, I want to justify the point I mentioned earlier. This is international law. According to valid interpretations of international law, Israel is already in an aggressive position because it's an illegal occupier. And by virtue of that, they have no right. The idea I have a right to defend myself is, well, you're already in aggressive stance, right? So therefore, they're in an aggressive posture. So, and from that perspective, legally, they have no right. Now, you could talk about the moral question, that's fine. But legally, they don't have any right to defend themselves because they're an illegal occupier. And you're just framing as it's just Hamas. Notwithstanding Hamas and Islamic Jihad, they're proscribed terrorist groups according to the United Kingdom. There are other factions within the resistance that are legal, and they're using the international right according to the Geneva Convention and international law to actually resist an occupying force. They're actually allowed to resist an occupying force. This is international law.
Yeah, look. I'll tell you what. Look.
Yeah, what? Is it international law? Are you allowed to resist an occupying force?
Here's a question. Gaza is not occupied.
It is occupied.
Is now, right?
No. It is occupied. According to international law, because Israel had control of resources...
Gaza is going to be occupied now for decades.
Listen, this is rhetoric. Listen.
No, it's not rhetoric.
According to international law, even notwithstanding the fact that the Israeli settlers left, illegal settlers, may I add, because Israel had control of the population to a degree, electricity, water, and so on and so forth, it's still considered as an occupier force according to international law. So you can't say it's not occupied because it's still considered occupied. This is why there is a resistance movement. This is why there are valid legal factions.
It's not why there's a resistance movement.
Of course there is. It's not just Hamas and Islamic Jihad. There are other factions that are trying to resist the occupier.
Gazans' issues since 2005... are all self-inflicted. What Gazans could have done was they could have chosen a different path after 2005. They could have said, well, our brothers in the West Bank can deal with their own lives. We're going to pursue our life here. There's a border, and that's the way...
So let's stay occupied, right?
Okay, guys, so in all that's been said, and to conclude, how do we now see, and I'm going to ask you first, Mark, how do we now see the two-state solution and how do we move forward?
Okay, I think the two-state solution is dead as a dodo at the moment. I say at the moment, the dodo is not coming back, but dead as a dodo probably for the next couple of decades. It was already in severe trouble the Second Intifada. I think the Second Intifada really killed off the idea. The idea of a two-state solution is that some border could be agreed, that Israel would exist and some Palestinian state would exist, and that by doing that, by defining borders, there would be less war, not more war. Now, Israelis fundamentally now believe that any such border, no matter what it was, would lead to more war. Would lead to a horrific war. So let's say some deal was agreed, and some Israeli government was stupid enough to sign up to it, for some border on the West Bank, and maybe some settlements were kept and some were closed, and there's some border. The problem is, most Israelis, I think, would now feel that that would be another Gaza, that then heavy weapons would be brought in, perhaps artillery, into the West Bank, rockets would be coming through 24/7, and everybody would be, all the terrorists and jihadists would be gathering in the West Bank for the final destruction, the final war to destroy Israel. It would be Gaza times 10. Gaza was a trial run for the two-state solution. It was a trial run. Gazans could have ignored Israel. They could have lived in peace and prosperity. They could have enjoyed their lives. They rejected that. And Palestinians of the West Bank would probably reject it too. So the two-state solution is dead. What happens now, nobody really knows. I had optimism before, not much optimism, but at least a bit, before 7th of October. I have no optimism now. I had a plan that could be followed, that I believed in, and I think many Israeli people did, or pro-Israeli people. But I don't think we do know. I don't think Israel knows what it's going to do if, and probably when, later this year, it actually destroys Hamas. It's not going to solve its problems on the northern border and the West Bank. It's going to lead to a whole load of new problems in Gaza. You know, are they going to be able to stop a new terrorist group taken over, maybe rebrand it? So I don't think Israel has some kind of answer as to what it's doing. What Israel has is it's in absolute shock that Hamas was able to do this attack on the 7th of October. It's absolutely determined that Hamas will now no longer exist, except maybe in a hotel in Qatar. But it will no longer exist in Gaza. And as I think I said earlier, whatever we say, that's really its plan. But I'm afraid I've no hope really to bring. The only hope in this conflict, which I did mention earlier on, is that Palestinians change their ideas about the future and about what they want. But unfortunately, I really see almost no sign of that. And I see almost no sign that their allies, like Hamza, in their allies in the West and around the world, are even interested in getting them to do that. So I'm afraid there's nothing I can say. The problem can be easily solved if Palestinians decide we'll just compromise, we'll lose some of our territory, we'll have some kind of state, we'll live in peace. War with the Jews was a bad idea. We'll put it all behind us, like Germans in the 1950s. But there's no sign of that happening. Maybe it'll happen among the Gazans. That could be the only possible thing. Maybe after the terrible loss of their war, that they'll be like Germans in the 1950s and they won't want to pursue the struggle anymore in 2025 going forward. But that's a tiny little crumb of hope. I'm afraid I've no hope to give you, I think.
Hamza?
Yeah, so it's interesting that we have othering language, which leads to dehumanization, and dehumanization leads to genocide. The Palestinians change the ideas, as if we know all of the ideas of the Muslim, Christian Palestinians, the kind of othering that is happening in your language, and also the subtlety between war against Israel, now war against the Jews, is these subtleties, these kind of propaganda techniques, which are quite, in fact, quite devilish. I know you're an atheist, so don't take it personally because you don't believe in the devil. But the point is, it's a devilish ploy because it is well known that the Palestinians, Muslims as well in general, have never wanted to fight the Jews. In actual fact, Islam preserved the Jewish community. Philip Mansell's book, Constantinople, has a primary source of a Jewish rabbi that was expelled from Spain because of the Inquisition. He said, come to the land of the Turks, rich are the fruits of the earth, we live in peace and freedom. Amnon Cohen, a Jewish historian, he's got a book called World Within. It's a two-volume book. He collects 1,000 records of the judicial records, the sigil records. And he concludes that although the Jews had the freedom to go to the rabbinical courts, the majority of them, or a substantial number of them, wanted to go to the Qadi, the Islamic judge, because the new justice lived under the Islamic principles. He even goes to the minutiae, and he says women would complain of nafaqa, meaning maintenance from their husband to the Islamic judge.
And I could go on and on and on. Zion Zohar, you could talk about jihad. True jihad is liberation of people. Zion Zohar, another Jewish historian, he talks about the Iberian Peninsula. He says, thus, when the Muslims crossed the Straits of Gibraltar in the Iberian Peninsula, the Jews saw the Muslims as liberators from Christian persecution. And if you look at the treaty of the Prophet Muhammad, upon him be peace himself, he had a treaty with the Jews, with the Jewish tribes, and he said they should not be harmed, and they act as one body. This is unprecedented in history. We're not fighting the Jews, we're fighting Zionism. Our job is to take care of all human beings.